And good Thursday afternoon. It's Thursday, May 28th. And this program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to community news covering the towns of Marlborough, Hudson, Harvard, Stowe, and Bolton. This program is sponsored in part by the Lions Clubs of Ashland, Bolton, and Harvard. And thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. In the next hour, we'll be bringing you news from the Community Advocate, Harvard Press, Stowe Independent, and Bolton Independent. Today we'll be reading from the newspapers, the May 22nd editions of the Harvard Press and the Marlborough-Hudson Community Advocate, and the Stowe and Bolton Independent, some late April articles. This is Tim Elms, along with Bob Brady, reading to you live from the Patricia A. Fletcher Studio at Audio Journal in Worcester, Massachusetts. And I'm going to start with underwear, nips, and cigarette butts. Volunteers collect 258 bags of trash and invasive weeds by Julie Gowell. Volunteers for the annual townwide cleanup in April learned exactly what ends up along Harvard's roadsides, trails, and public spaces over the course of a year. A little bit of everything. A plastic eyeball, a sofa cushion, a golf club, multiple pairs of underwear, a broken postal crate, a negative COVID test, and a sawhorse. That's not even all of the oddities found by the nearly 200 volunteers that turned out to clean up 70% of the town's most frequented areas. This year's annual initiative took place from Thursday, April 23rd through Sunday, April 26th, coinciding with Earth Day on the 22nd. Volunteers reported collecting 258 bags of trash, down from last year's 294 bags, along with pulling a great deal of the invasive garlic mustard weeds sprouting up around town. The multi-day event drew a broad mix of community volunteers, including Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, Bromfield National Honor Society students, families, and neighborhood groups. The Cub Scouts alone fielded 16 volunteers across several locations, while the Harvard Family Association brought 13 participants to the cemetery in the town center. Organizers also gave special recognition to Jordan Smith, who single-handedly cleaned Mass Ave from Westward Orchards to the Boxborough Line, saying, "It looks amazing." While the numbers tell a story of neighbors taking pride and ownership in their community, the volunteer comments collected on the online sign-up forum and given to the press by cleanup organizers tell a far more entertaining tale of the fun people can have while picking up trash. This year's efforts turned some participants into amateur roadside anthropologists, trying to decode the habits of the town's messiest passerby. Smirnoff vodka is by far the most popular alcoholic beverage of Brown Road drivers, said Christopher Califu, who reported finding many nips along his route. Pall Mall cigarettes were a favorite for a frequent driver of Stowe Road, said Christine Roy. One of the Harvard cleanup group organizers, Libby Levison, had a very specific grievance. Aroma Joe's cold drink cups are evil. They shatter, not break, she said of her finds on Old Shirley Road. Some of the most commonly reported items were the usual suspects: nip bottles, cigarette butts, fast food packaging, and drink containers. Alcohol nips appear so frequently in volunteer reports that several residents began offering their own tongue-in-cheek market analysis. One volunteer counted 21 nip bottles along a single stretch of Ayer Road, while another discovered a perfect pile of 12 bottles on Poor Farm Road. Fast food debris, crushed coffee cups, plastic bottles, and crash-related auto parts also made regular appearances. mostly the expected amount of booze containers and a handful of plastic chunks from cars and a negative COVID test. So good news there, said John Cushing, who cleaned Whitney Road. Four bags of cans, nips, and auto parts, added Ann Bohan of her finds at the intersection of Poor Farm and Air Roads. One bag of trash, one bag of garlic mustard, and one car bumper left from a winter crash, found Robin Carla on Woodchuck Hill Road. Carrie Fraser tidied Still River Road, pulling a sawhorse from a swampy section of land adjacent to the road, and was negatively rewarded for her efforts when a car driving past threw McDonald's leftovers out the window where she was collecting trash. For many volunteers, litter wasn't exactly the biggest problem. Instead, the aggressive, invasive weed garlic mustard was the day's dominant adversary. Kit Holland, who cleaned Metacomet Path, said she came across so much garlic mustard and poison ivy, she was unable to remove it all and planned to return on her own time to finish the job. Too much to pick, reported Marissa Steele, who was working on Air Road. Dana Oliver, while clearing Merrick Lane, reported many more patches this year. Other residents found a reduction in the amount of garlic mustard from previous years. Bob Abraham, in his description of Finn Road, said he collected 1.5 bags of the weed, which was less than he pulled last year. Lynn Adler made the same observation of Stowe Road. And amid the stories of discarded booze containers, mystery underwear, and roadside oddities, one comment offered perhaps the best reminder of why people keep showing up. Lots of friendly people saying thanks, said Forsgaard. For a few spring days, Harvard's annual townwide cleanup served as an environment initiative and a scavenger hunt. Somewhere out there, someone is still missing a plastic eyeball and their undergarments. Plans for 234 apartments cannot advance without state grants for a new water sewer system, by Valerie Hurley. Minko Corporation wants to build 234 rental apartments in the town's multifamily district at the intersection of Route 2 and Air Road. But it needs state grants to afford the development's expensive water and sewer system. Minko Representative Alex Loth asked the select board Tuesday evening to apply for two grants to help pay for the $9 million system to serve the multifamily homes. Loth said Minko would contribute $1.5 million toward the system. Project proponent Lou Russo said he believes the town is very well positioned to qualify for two grants of up to $5 million each from the Mass Works and Mass Housing programs. So the hope is that the town does not have to do any bond issue to pay for this, he said. He pointed out that Harvard had already received $1.1 million from the state's Catalyst Fund to design the sewer and water system, a task completed by engineering firm Woodward and Curran last March and reported in the April 17th issue of the Harvard Press. At that time, engineers had produced two plans. One is a $16 million system designed specifically for extension to Air Road's commercial district. That includes Blanchard, Lancaster County, and Old Mill Roads. The other is a $9 million system to serve the proposed apartments using components and a layout less easily extensible to the commercial district. The $9 million system is what Russo said he and Minko want to pursue, saying it could be extended to Air Road. He said the sewer plant proposed for the system would be close enough to Air Road to allow for tie-ins up and down the road in the future. But Russo's confidence that the town could get two grants was not shared by interim town administrator Don Dunbar. Both Eric Ryder, DPW director, and I think the chance of getting more than one grant is slim, she told the board. She also said the grants are meant for shovel-ready projects, a status not applicable to this project. They want something that is ready to go the minute we get the money. Meeting the June 3rd application deadline would also be difficult, she said. Minco Corp. has not yet submitted an application to the planning board, but on Tuesday presented its own fiscal analysis showing a $1 million annual revenue to the town from property tax, excise tax, and community preservation surcharges. The net benefit to Harvard, Minco estimated, would be $523,000 annually against municipal costs of $476,000 for schools and police and fire services. According to Minco's preliminary plans, Harvard Village would consist of five buildings containing a total of 234 rental apartments. Two-bedroom units would number 117, while the remaining 117 apartments would be studios, one-bedrooms, or one-bedrooms with dens. Situated next to the new Boston Badminton facility, the apartments would be built on the town's 8-acre multifamily zone, approved by town meeting in 2024 in compliance with the state's MBTA Communities Act. However, the plans indicate that Minco will apply for permits under provisions of both the multifamily bylaw and the recently replaced Air Road Village Special Permit Zoning. The developer is entitled to do so under the state law that allows older zoning to be used if permission was granted before the new zoning was enacted. Tax aid applications for elderly or disabled residents due next week by Marty Green. For more than 20 years, Harvard has offered elderly or disabled homeowners help in paying their property tax bills. This year, applications for that assistance are due to the town treasurer, actually today, May 28th. The Elderly and Disabled Taxation Aid Committee will decide by June 20th the amount of assistance to give each approved applicant. We want to encourage everyone who feels the need to apply, said Debbie Thompson, who serves on the committee in her position as Director of the Council on Aging. We want to give out as much money as possible. Both Thompson and committee member Barbara Kemp expressed concern at the limited number of applications they receive, sometimes only four or five. What bothers me is that very few people apply, Kemp said. I feel sure there are many people who would qualify. There have to be people in town who live close to the edge. Thompson and Kemp also emphasized that the names of applicants are completely confidential. The committee's discussion of the applications takes place in executive session, and no names appear in the minutes. Money for the Elderly and Disabled Tax Fund comes entirely from private donations. Town Treasurer Lindsay Ames, who also serves on the committee, sends an insert with the July tax bills explaining how to donate to the fund. The Council on Aging also includes that information in its newsletter around tax time. The donations are tax deductible on state and federal income tax forms. To qualify for this local assistance program, applicants must be at least 65 or have a disability that makes them unable to work. An applicant must also have owned taxable property in Harvard for at least a year. Thompson said most people who apply have lived in town for many years. The assistance program has income limits, but those limits can be flexible. This year's income limits are $51,777 for a single person and $67,709 for a couple. The limits have risen sharply over the years to take account of inflation and the rising cost of living. Applicants must include copies of their federal tax forms for 2025 with their applications. Residents whose income is somewhat over the limit but who have had unusual expenses such as major medical bills should still consider applying, Thompson said. The committee would take these circumstances into consideration the Elderly and Disabled Taxation Aid Committee meet once a year to review the applications for aid. Let's take a short break, then we'll pass it over to Bob with more news.
Are you a senior who is dealing with vision loss? Would you like to learn about advocacy efforts on behalf of seniors who are blind? And about support calls, where you can talk with other seniors who are also dealing with vision loss? If so, join us, the Alliance on Aging and Vision Loss, an affiliate of the American Council of the Blind. To learn more, visit our website, www.aavl-blind-seniors.org.
This is Bob Brady with Audio Journal. The time is 3:15. I'm going to read articles from the Marlboro Hudson Community Advocate. Hudson Town Manager Will Not Seek Renewal of Contract, by Paul Hopkins. At a May 18th Select Board meeting, Hudson Town Manager Thomas Gregory said he will not seek a renewal of his contract when it expires next year. Gregory, who joined Hudson in 2021, said that he will remain 100% committed to this job and to this town in the interim. The news comes after a lukewarm performance evaluation from the Select Board. Gregory said he appreciated the board's evaluation and feedback. "It's been a challenging year, and I will continue to work on those areas needing improvement," he added. Stephen Sharrock, the new Select Board chair, said that, to his knowledge, Gregory's evaluation marked the first time the Select Board had evaluated a town manager or an equivalent position. He said the review is not a perfect process, calling it a learning experience. Four board members, former Chair Scott DePlissy, Sharrock, Diane Bemis, and Lauren DeBrule, assessed Gregory on 8 categories: professionalism and individual characteristics, knowledge and training, public relations and communications, board support and relations, community leadership, organizational leadership, and personnel management, financial management, and town planning and organization. Each category included between 3 and 8 subcategories. On a 5-point scale, with a 5 being the highest, Gregory scored a 3.15. Gregory grew up in Shrewsbury and taught Latin and history at St. Sebastian's School in Needham. Seeking a career change, Gregory took an entry-level job in Worcester's Housing and Neighborhood Development Department. He then decided to go back to school and earn his master's in public administration from Clark University. Eventually, Gregory took a job in Shrewsbury as the assistant to the town manager. He later became the assistant town manager in Walpole before becoming the town administrator in Spencer. Nunzi had a story to tell: how a near-death experience helped a Marlboro World War II veteran connect with others, by Sofia Apetisano. On the morning of March 19, 1945, then 22-year-old Marlboro resident Nunzio Martino began another ordinary day as a U.S. Navy machinist aboard the USS Benjamin Franklin, a carrier ship operating in the Pacific Ocean during World War II. It was a Sunday morning, just after 7 a.m., when the first enemy torpedo struck the ship 50 miles off the coast of the Japanese mainland, according to a letter Nunzi sent to his wife, Regina, in the days following the attack. A second torpedo sent the ship up in flames. Within minutes, it was dead in the water. "I speak the truth when I say that we thought we wouldn't get through the ordeal," Nunzi wrote. He was trapped for 2 hours on the second deck before he managed to escape and catch a glimpse of the horrors of the attack. only 704 of the original 3,000 crew members survived. But the USS Franklin remained afloat as it was towed back to Ulithi, an atoll in the Pacific Ocean. It was the most damaged ship to return from the war. Nunzi passed away 3 years ago. He was 101. Now his son, Dick Martino, 77, is the keeper of this incredible story. As a reporter spoke with him, he thumbed through priceless documents and books searching for Nunzi's letter to Regina. He pulled the original letter out of an envelope labeled Dad's Letter 1945. He wrote this from memory. The day was emblazoned in his mind, Dick said. Dick, a retired deacon and U.S. Navy captain, retired after 38 years from his optometry practice in Northboro. He is currently the fire and police chaplain in Northboro and has also taken on the task of preserving his father's history, a duty many veteran families hold dear. People today don't understand how much veterans sacrificed, David said. If we don't pay attention, everything they did for us won't be preserved. We have to keep listening to them. Nunzi didn't open up about his experience on the USS Benjamin Franklin until he attended a gathering in honor of the USS Guam, a carrier assigned to escort the ship back home. Dick said his father lit up talking to the other men about that fateful day in the Pacific. After that, Nunzi told his story to anyone who would listen. Nunzi was a member of the Italian-American War Veterans Post No. 45 in Marlboro, where a booth is reserved exclusively for World War II veterans, unless they invite someone else to sit with them. A photo of Nunzi and Dick sitting in that booth is framed and hangs right above it. At the time, Dick didn't want to include a name plaque. Nunzi insisted that one be added. He wanted people to know, Dick said. Nunzi also recorded an oral history of his experiences with the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and eventually joined the VA after a push from Dick. Nunzi was the last Marlboro World War II veteran to pass, and Dick said the network of veteran services in Marlboro was very special to him. Marlboro Senior Center Veteran Services Officer Mike Hennessy set Nunzi up with the VA, which aided with end-of-life care. Dick said Hennessy is beloved by Marlboro veterans because, as a veteran himself, he's been there. He just gets it, gets them. Hudson may fly Canadian flag at Town Hall, by Paul Hopkins. The select board, with near unanimous backing from the town meeting, is being asked to restore a Canadian flag to the Sallouche Memorial outside Town Hall. The request was a citizen's petition brought by Richard Harity, who served as the town's moderator from 1985 to 2025. Harity noted that when the Sallouche Memorial was established through the efforts of the Rotary Club around 2015, a Canadian flag flew on one of the lesser flagpoles to honor Sallouche's service as U.S. ambassador to Canada. That changed when a standardized flag policy was adopted by the Select Board. Former Select Board member Scott DePlissy, at his final meeting as a board member, said he wouldn't argue with the praise offered for Sallouche, but I'm cautious about flying another country's flag, DePlissy said. What if Mr. Sallouche had been the ambassador to Russia or China? Would we be flying those flags? To fly another country's flag, to me, is unacceptable. Harity said he understood the objection, but pointed out that the request to amend the flag policy was narrow and only meant for one location. He also noted Sallouche's contribution, saying that reviewing the life of Paul Sallouche would take us to midnight, and that, when the memorial was first dedicated, Canada's Consul General to New England personally donated the flag. The request passed overwhelmingly, but three members of the select board voted nay: DuPlessis, Diane Bemis, and Lauren DeBrule. Cellucci was born in Hudson in 1948 and graduated from Hudson Catholic High School. He served on a number of town boards, including several terms on the select board in the 1970s. He later served the Massachusetts House of Representatives before being elected lieutenant governor in 1991. He served as the governor of Massachusetts from 1997 to 2001. He is said to have never lost an election. In Marlborough, you can walk on water. Come to Marlborough and walk on water. No miracles needed. The Lake Williams Floating Boardwalk has become a top attraction in the city, allowing people to walk on top of a 113-acre lake on a floating pathway. The boardwalk, completed in 2023, spans more than 3,000 feet. It cost almost $2 million in American Rescue Plan Act, ARPA, funds to complete the project. I would like to thank our federal delegation for securing the American Rescue Plan Act funding. This funding enabled us to expand on a recreational trail along the lake for residents of all ages to enjoy. We are excited for residents to use this unique path to explore Lake Williams and the surrounding area, then Mayor Arthur Vigent said in 2023. The floating boardwalk at Lake Williams will close the walking loop and create yet another opportunity for families to get outside and enjoy all Marlborough has to offer. These types of tangible benefits for the community are exactly what I had in mind when I voted for the American Rescue Plan, Congresswoman Lori Trahan said at the time. I'm grateful to Mayor Vigent and the City Council for prioritizing this project. As Vigent and Trahan said, there's plenty of other recreation opportunities around Lake Williams. The boardwalk is part of a 1.5-mile trail loop that follows the perimeter of the lake. The trails wind through the woods and can be accessed off Lazotte Drive. Mayor J. Christian DeMays has also been a supporter of the boardwalk. Driving by and seeing everyone doing selfies is pretty cool because you can see it when you're driving by. So people are enjoying it, DeMays told CBS last year. Something new, something exciting, something different that other communities don't have. So now, if Marlborough can be a destination for this, then why not? The boardwalk officially opened just before Memorial Day. The walkway is open from dawn to dusk, though parking at nearby Marlborough District Court is not allowed on weekdays between 8:30 a.m. and 4:30 p.m. Remember, there shall be no fishing, dog walking, swimming, or boating. Biking, hunting, motorized vehicles, fires, littering, cutting or removing of trees or plants, and camping are also prohibited. Marlborough will host official World Cup celebration this summer. The Metro West Boston Visitors Bureau, in partnership with the City of Marlborough, announced plans for a coordinated Metro West Regional Fan Zone initiative to celebrate the 2026 FIFA World Cup and bring a major tournament viewing event to the region. The World Cup is a hugely unifying global event, and this initiative brings that energy directly to Metro West, said Stacy David, executive director of the Metro West Boston Visitors Bureau. By working together across communities, we're creating a regional hub where residents and visitors can experience the excitement of the tournament and celebrate together. It's also an opportunity to showcase the region, encouraging visitors to stay, explore, and support local businesses while generating meaningful economic impact across Metro West. Each fan zone will feature live match broadcasts on a jumbotron surrounded by an outdoor festival with a beer garden, food trucks, arts and crafts, other vendors, and family-friendly activities. Organizers expect the events to draw thousands of attendees daily. Marlboro's Fan Zone will take place June 11th to 13th at Kelleher Field with live streams of Mexico versus South Africa June 11th, USA versus Paraguay June 12th, Brazil versus Morocco, and Haiti versus Scotland June 13th. Marlboro is proud to host a fan zone that reflects the diversity and international spirit of our community, said Mayor J. Christian DeMays. The World Cup brings together fans from all backgrounds, and our match lineup and festival atmosphere are designed to celebrate that energy, creating a space where people can share their passion for the game and experience the excitement in a way that feels both global and local. Now, let's listen to a public service announcement, and then Tim will bring us more news.
Hello, listeners. Would you like to hear news from Holden, Paxton, Princeton, Rutland, and Sterling that you're not likely to hear on commercial television and radio? Tune in to Audio Journal every Friday at 7 a.m. and again at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
And this is Tim. It's time 3:30 on Thursday, May 28th. And this one's titled, Children's Book Promotes Understanding of How an Autistic Child Sees the World, by Carlene Phillips. Jackson the Elephant, Finding His Way in the Jungle, is a young children's book written by Harvard resident Deborah Souza. The jungle in this case is the world seen through the eyes of an autistic child, and the story, written for classrooms and families, provides suggestions for helping a child manage that world. The fictional Jackson is based on Souza's 12-year-old autistic son of the same name. Souza's personal experiences and her 14 years of working as a therapist with children on the spectrum qualify her as a perfect guide through this jungle. When Jackson the elephant arrives for the first day of school, he is feeling excited about but also very anxious. What helps him is that his support teacher meets him right away and gives him a step-by-step plan for how the day will go. Souza said knowing what comes next, including possible movements and noises, helps a child feel calm. With her son, Souza said, I have to be 10 steps ahead of how I think he will react. She described the family trip to New York City. One of Jackson's favorite movies is Home Alone, and he wanted to stay at the Plaza, like Kevin in the movie. He was upset when Souza explained that it was too expensive, but she promised him they would visit the hotel. To avoid a scene if things did not go as expected, Souza called the hotel, explained the situation, and asked if the family could visit. Not only did they visit, the hotel insisted the family spend the night, and they gave Jackson a backpack. In the book, Jackson had things around him that made him feel safe and ready, headphones to block noise, and his tablet to use for voice-to-text when he is having trouble expressing himself. At one point in the day, Jackson accidentally knocked his pencil case off his desk, and other kids looked to see what the noise was. Pencils scattered, and Jackson became overwhelmed with embarrassment and self-blame. And he forgot how to stay calm. A loud noise burst from him, and tears filled his eyes. Jackson's support teacher helped his body feel safe again, and it helped to walk away and get calm. Souza said other kids can think an upset child is trying to scare them, and it helps them to know that the child's feelings were just too big all at once. A teacher can tell other students that they may ask when a good time to play with Jackson is. With support, everyone can feel safe and included. Sousa said it's usually best to remove an overwhelmed child from the situation and de-escalate in private. The book also helps children who may wonder why a teacher is always working with only the same child to understand that some people's brains work differently. Sousa said having worked as a behavioral therapist made her better prepared to have an autistic child than someone without that experience. Still, it's a lot, and with Jackson, it's like walking on eggshells. She helps her husband, Eduardo, with his business, Beyond Construction Masonry. I do everything except the labor, she said. They have 9-year-old twins, a boy and a girl. She said what is hardest for her is the judgment of other people. At a restaurant or the grocery store, if Jackson suddenly screams or swears, she feels other people are thinking what a bad parent she is. There are no external hints that show a brain wired differently. Jackson Sousa is now attending the Neshoba Learning Group in Bedford, where kids practice all kinds of situations. They cook, do laundry. They cook, do laundry, sit in a mock barbershop chair, and go to the grocery store. He is comfortable and outgoing there, and even tries to lead a tour when a new family is being shown the school. Using YouTube tutorials, he has made his own films based on Jurassic Park and Star Wars, drawing characters, animating them, and doing voiceovers. I have no idea how he does it, said Sousa. He's building things on a 3D printer, which also astounds his mom. She said Jackson has a big personality, and parents in town have been super supportive. Sousa had been thinking about writing a book for 2 years. She wasn't sure how successful her finished book might be, so she used AI for illustrations rather than paying a lot of money for an illustrator. She told the program exactly what she wanted. Jackson the elephant is much larger than his animal friends, perhaps to show that he can sometimes seem threatening until they understand him. The illustrations dominate the pages with only a couple of short sentences on each. Sousa said she wanted kids to really take in the words. So there are more pages with fewer words on each. Currently, the book is available on Amazon and at the general store. Her husband, who is Brazilian, helped Sousa translate the book into Portuguese. And this one is titled Fruitlands Museum opens its season with Eye of the Beholder expedition. And this is by Carlene Phillips. Imagine walking into a large storage facility and being faced with hundreds of objects, paintings, pieces of furniture, sculptures, personal and everyday items, mostly from the 19th century. Now imagine having to choose which 40 or 50 objects are worthy of being in an exhibition. This was the challenge facing Tess Lukey, associate curator of Native American art at Fruitlands Museum. She was tasked with curating an exhibit of items from the unconventional collection of Clara Endicott Sears, called Eye of the Beholder. It opens in the Four Seasons Gallery on April 30th. And runs until November 7th, 2027. Some of the items have never been on display before. Based on her extensive knowledge of Sears, gained through writings about her and various records she left, Lukey chose objects that she said reflect both the breadth of Sears, collecting interests, and the personal histories embedded in the objects she preserved. Lukey said Sears collected with a deeply personal sense of curiosity. The exhibit is a glimpse into the material culture and personal stories that fascinated Clara Endicott Sears. All curators also choose items that speak to them, and so this exhibit also reflects items in which Lukey sees her own connections. "There's a lot of me in this collection," she said. Lukey explained that the idiom, "beauty is in the eye of the beholder," first appears in print in an 1878 romance novel, Molly Bawn. Though the concept dates back well before then, Lukey said it offers a frame of reference, a wider lens through which to view the collection. The exhibit brings together objects that might not always align with today's definition of beauty, but each one reflects a story about the people who owned it or made it, the time it came from, and why Sears believed it was worth preserving. The exhibit itself is aesthetically pleasing while also thought-provoking. Items are hung gallery style in the smaller space of the Four Seasons Gallery. The background walls are painted pink. "She loved pink," said Lukey of Sears. On the wall opposite the collection is a large painting of Sears dressed in a soft pink dress with pink in the background. Lukey said the portrait of Sears, done probably when she was in her 30s, has not been on display for many years. The pink color shows Sears' personal taste, underscoring that the items in the collection reflect her values and her vision of beauty. Two sets of buttons belonging to her father, who died when Sears was in her late 20s, show the importance of family to her. And utilitarian objects like a spatula show her desire to capture the material culture of the 19th century. And this one is Bee Swarms, House Hunting, Dancing, and Survival by Christian Dijon. Honeybee swarms may seem chaotic, but they are actually well-choreographed house hunting missions. The moving clumps of bees are not aggressive. They are working to keep their queen warm while waiting for forager bees to find a home. In last week's edition, we explored why it occurs. If bees feel crowded, the colony splits, creates a new queen in the old hive, and leaves with the existing queen to find a new home. If forager bees have been found, if they've found a good location, they begin what's known as the waggle dance, a figure-eight movement used to communicate direction, distance, and quality of potential nesting sites. The more vigorously a bee dances, the more insistent it is that it's found the best spot. That said, colonies rarely survive winter in first homes. They have to expend so much energy making honeycomb, they don't have enough time to build up pollen for the winter. Their chances of survival increase if they find a furnished home, an abandoned hive, or a prepared space. This is why contacting a beekeeper can be the best way to keep them alive. Blue herons in Stowe. We often see great blue herons walking, but they do fly and nest in trees and platforms like other birds. Though they will sometimes settle in bushes and the ground, Stowe resident David Gray took these photos. According to the National Audubon Society, blue herons usually return to the same sites each year and lay up to 6 blue eggs, which take about a month to hatch. The young birds leave after about 2 to 3 months. Town to welcome new director of economic and community development. The town will welcome a new director of economic and community development, a position vacant since Chris Ryan left that post in 2022. Jenny Gingras, currently employed as the director of planning in Westboro, will start June 1st and be introduced to the select board at its June 2nd meeting. Gingras previously served as a zoning administrator for Lexington and is the first town planner in Pepperell, where she lives. According to the town's charter, the job entails accomplishing community and economic goals as envisioned by the Select Board. Serving as town planner, coordinating the activities of agencies with jurisdiction over development and conservation, and coordinating all economic land use and community development planning in the town. We interviewed these applicants, and Jenny really stood out from the rest. Let's take another short break, and we'll pass it back over to Bob.
Have you listened to one of Audio Journal's most popular shows, Talking Topics, with host Bill Ruggiero? You can catch it on the second weekend of each month, airing Saturday at 3 p.m. and again on Sunday at 6 p.m. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
This is Bob Brady back with Audio Journal. The time is 3:45. I'm going to continue with articles from the Marlboro-Hudson Community Advocate. Sydney Roush didn't let 12 surgeries stop her from playing softball, by Evan Walsh. When Sydney Roush was born, her fingers were webbed, stuck together. Amniotic band syndrome, a rare condition where fibrous strands entangle and restrict blood flow to a developing fetus, had affected the growth of both her hands and one of her feet. As a two-week-old baby, Roush had her first surgery. As a five-year-old, she had been through five operations, and today she estimates she's had at least 12 procedures, each designed to give her more mobility in her hands. Still, medical experts weren't certain what Roush would be able to accomplish. "They didn't know what I was going to be able to do," she said. But that didn't and couldn't stop Roush. The 16-year-old sophomore has hardly let her condition slow her down, becoming a leader and significant contributor to Hudson's softball program. "None of us know what she's going through, but I have so much respect for her that she never really makes an excuse about it," said head coach Laura Bowen, who has known Roush for the last 8 years. "She doesn't even make it known, just the way she plays, grips the bat, grips the ball. It's incredible." Even with the constant surgeries growing up, Roush starting softball wasn't even a decision, according to her mother, Lindsay. Her twin brother, Thomas, was ready for baseball, and she quickly and eagerly followed his lead. "I wanted to try it, and I immediately fell in love with it," said Roush. But Roush's enthusiasm didn't make the sport come easy. She had difficulty wrapping her hands, which she estimates haven't grown since she was a five-year-old, around the softball. When the ball got bigger to start 12U competition, it presented another challenge. "It was like I was restarting," she said. Undeterred, Roush kept working. Though her shorter-than-average fingers and limited mobility of her throwing hand limited the distance she can throw, she's found a role as the team's full-time second baseman. "It can be hard to wrap my hand around the ball, but I work through it," she said. And her challenges have turned her into one of the scrappiest and toughest players around. Roush was pulled up to varsity as a seventh grader, starting as an eighth grader on a team that made it to the championship game. This year, Roush, just a sophomore, may be the oldest infielder, depending on the lineup. Though her hands are different from those of her peers, athletics have allowed Roush to focus on what makes her similar to her teammates, a love of staying active, being a member of a team, and playing for their hometown. Roush said she relishes every moment of being a Hudson ball player. "When I was younger, kids would always say stuff about my hands, but that's just what kids do. It's normal. I never took it personally," said Roush. "My parents told me to ignore them because they didn't know who I was. In softball, it didn't impact how they looked at me as a player." She's my best friend, so it's been great to see her grow up from being uncomfortable at 10U softball to now when she's such a big part of her team. Watching her play, you would literally have no idea she's dealing with that, just her leadership and how she acts. I'm so proud of her, said Liv Connolly, a junior captain. Last year, Roush had shoulder surgery, missing her freshman Hudson campaign. Of course, that couldn't stop her either. She is extremely driven. She sets extremely high expectations of herself. She puts herself out there. She's a force to be reckoned with, said Lindsay Roush. Determined, hard-headed, she's a tough chick, and we're really proud of her. For Roush, what success without a little challenge? You have to keep pushing through the hard stuff. You need to know what you're capable of, she said. You can do it. Keep going. St. Mary's Credit Union announces new CEO. St. Mary's Credit Union announced a leadership transition with Jim Petkowicz named president and chief executive officer. The leadership change is effective immediately. Petkowicz succeeds Grace Lee, who will depart the organization effective July 1st, 2026, and will support the completion of the previously announced merger with Metro West Community Federal Credit Union in the interim. Petkowicz brings more than 20 years of experience with SMCU, most recently serving as chief operating officer. He previously served as interim CEO and has led virtually every area of the credit union, providing deep operational knowledge and a strong understanding of the organization's strategy and member-focused mission. Jim is the right leader for this moment, said Brian Bouvier, newly elected chairman of the board of directors. He brings deep institutional knowledge, a steady and thoughtful leadership style, and a genuine commitment to our employees and members. The board has full confidence in his ability to lead St. Mary's Credit Union as we continue to build on our strong foundation and navigate this next chapter. I am honored to step into the role of president and CEO of St. Mary's Credit Union, said Petkowicz. This organization means so much to me, not just because of the work we do, but because of the people who make it possible every day. I deeply believe in our mission and the impact we have on our members and the communities we serve. I look forward to leading the team as we continue to focus on delivering exceptional service. SMCU confirmed that no immediate changes to operations or strategic direction are anticipated, and that key initiatives currently underway, including the merger process, will continue as planned. Our mission, strategy, and commitment to our members remain unchanged, Bouvier added. We are focused on maintaining momentum, supporting our team, continuing to deliver the high level of service our members expect. Nothing says summer like pollinators in the garden. The return of the ruby-throated hummingbird signals that the warm weather season is truly here. At New England Botanic Garden at Tower Hill in Boylston, Mass., these mighty little birds find plenty of nectar in reward for completing their long migrations north. Formal and naturalistic gardens across the nearly 200-acre property are alive with colorful blooms. As hummingbirds flit from flower to flower, a diverse host of other pollinators and beneficial insects join them. Charismatic pollinators make some of the best ambassadors of the natural world, says Lee Morgan, exhibitions manager at New England Botanic Garden. We're thrilled to share their awe-inspiring beauty and environmental significance in a bold new way during this summer's outdoor sculpture exhibition. Get ready to meet larger-than-life hummingbirds, butterflies, bees, beetles, and more through Glass in Flight at the Garden. This unforgettable exhibition was created by nationally recognized Tucson-based artist Alex Haveri, a self-described entomophile, or lover of insects. Haveri celebrates these creatures through vibrant sculptures expertly crafted from stained glass and steel. Making its New England debut, Glass in Flight features 30 different sculptures, including several never-before-seen pieces depicting species native to the region. Through November 1st, visitors can encounter them all shimmering in the sunlight, soaring overhead, posing in midair, and even hiding among the blooms. Not all pollinators fly by day. As the evenings get longer, twilight experiences return to New England Botanic Garden. On Wednesdays and Thursdays, beginning June 17th and continuing through August, the garden stays open late. Visitors can enjoy Glass in Flight by golden hour. Wednesdays feature food and drink specials, and on Thursday, there's a beer garden and live music. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you'd like a hard copy of our program schedule in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org. This is Bob Brady, along with Tim Elms. Thank you for listening.
This is Bird Note. She was an incredible astronomer, master of the stars, extremely knowledgeable of landscapes and geography, an expert forager and healer, an amazing naturalist. She was in tune with the birds and their calls, notably the hoot of a barred owl. Harriet Tubman was a heroic abolitionist in the cause to end chattel slavery and an expert birder. On the Underground Railroad, Tubman used the song of the barred owl as a signal to let freedom seekers know that she had arrived. Her call let them know when it was safe to come out. She mastered the sound and used it throughout the Underground Railroad. After learning this story, I was inspired to learn this hoot myself in homage to Tubman. It was so smart to use the barred owl song as a signal. It's easily disguised, it's nature. She knew to use it at night when it would blend in with other nighttime sounds. But those in the know knew it was Tubman. And when they heard it, it was an important signal on a journey to freedom. This week is Black Birders Week. To learn how to participate, follow the hashtag Black Birders Week on social media and visit birdnote.org. I'm Tasha Lawson.
When my dad started to lose his vision, we were worried. Sure, his doctor gave me and my mom some handouts, and I did my fair share of research. But we had no idea how much of a challenge vision loss would be or how it would impact his quality of life. That's why I was so glad we discovered Mass Commission for the Blind. They work with my dad, and they will work with you and your loved one as well to develop future plans and new skills and assistive technology. They even helped Dad get access to talking books and newspapers. He was so excited.
If your loved one is blind or visually impaired, find out if they are eligible to register for services. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB. That's 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.